Hello and welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm Andrew Heaton. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We're going to be discussing a lot of things today, from the Paris Accord to the Manchester bombing to the Liberal Apology Tour and them eating their own. I'm joined by Nick Gillespie. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Andrew.
Matt Welch, hello.
Good morning and hello.
Thank you. And Catherine Mengu Ward.
Howdy.
And we began the day with the president beginning with a series of tweets and laying into the Justice Department about the travel ban and criticizing the mayor of London and really just stirring things up. Matt, what's your take on our president's response to what's going on in London?
There's a scene in The Thing John Carpenter where so many terrible things have happened wherever they are, some kind of ice station zebra, they're aliens. And at some point, a severed human head sprouts spider legs and starts walking down the way. And Kurt Russell's sidekick looks at it and just kind of like stops what he's doing and says, you got to be fucking kidding me. So I feel like that sometimes when President Trump today, the day after or 2 days after an attack in London, tweets out pathetic excuse by London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who had to think fast on his, quote, no reason to be alarmed, unquote, statement. MSM is working hard to sell it. You're calling out the London mayor. This is like 5 days after saying that he's going to be, he's elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris. And he's douching the London mayor for a quote that he's most certainly quoting terribly out of context. And it's just like, it's not hard to act better than that. And yet this is exactly who he has been his entire adult life. So occasionally you have to tilt your head sideways and say, you got to be kidding me. On the travel ban stuff, I mean, the ideology of Trump and the people around him are that the West is soft on terrorism, unlike Vladimir Putin and other people who are much stronger on it, and that so therefore we need to do something and get tough. And it's very symbolic, it seems to me. I mean, people are still trying to almost argue that that as soon as we correct the language and call radical Islamic terrorism by its name, then magically we will have won half the battle. And it just strikes me as weird. You're in charge now of a thing, a federal bureaucracy and a bunch of policies that come with it. And it takes more than symbolic talk to do things. And it also, you know, talk about one of our oldest allies in the world here. There's just a way to be more sympathetic than he is. And I think it speaks to kind of a limited pool of policies that are available to Trump. And, you know, I'm sure Catherine Nick will talk more about the travel ban itself. But the way that he tweeted it out this morning indicates to me that he is no longer interested in it actually being upheld by the Supreme Court. I think he likes it as an issue that is going to lose, that he can martyr himself.
Well, if I can point out my least favorite response to the London attacks was actually from Theresa May, the UK's prime minister, who immediately picked from a script that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton used in the same weekend in December of 2015 after the San Bernardino shootings, which was, we've got to shut down the internet. We've got to start taking seriously.
Remove online safe spaces.
Yeah. And
the
it's
use
just,
of safe space there is like she's personally trolling us.
Yeah. But that to me, ultimately, like Donald Trump, I think I've kind of incorporated a level of, you know, WTF into everything that he does. And Matt, I agree that the travel ban will not probably ever become law. And that's actually, that should give all of us who believe in kind of individual freedom and mobility a bit of a breather, because it means that our institutions and checks and balances are in place so that the president or the executive branch can't just exert, you know, some kind of weird authority over people. But more to the point, this whole idea of somehow the real problem in the world is, you know, is internet freedom, as opposed to the ways in which, you know, radical Islamic terrorists, you know, are motivated by jihad or whatever and are acting like fucking idiots. And also the failure of countries to assimilate and acculturate and kind of minimize terrorism. I actually found the mayor of London. That's exactly the right response. And it's the one that we all cheered George W. Bush for saying right after 9/11, you know, go out and, you know, buy socks and all of that kind of stuff. So for me, what's less troubling is Trump's response than, you know, than actually the kind of go-to response about shutting down the internet.
Yeah.
So is it potentially efficacious? Is this a Faustian bargain that we can make where we can give control of the internet to the government in exchange for safety? Or would that happen at all, Catherine?
No. I mean, this is something that people laughed at when this came up during the American presidential primary debates, this idea that we have to deny the terrorists the corners of the internet where they dwell, as if there are literally corners we could, like, put police tape around. You know, the removal of online safe spaces for terrorists is the same thing as the removal of online safe spaces for other types of dissidents who we should treasure and protect. I actually was more struck in May's remarks, though, by the only hard specific she offered, which was a proposal to increase custodial sentences for terrorism-related suspects, which I read as her essentially saying, we are going to further suspend due process whenever anyone says the word terrorism. And that's something that we are sort of constantly fighting the temptation to do that here in the United States. You know, she said, we're going to give the police all the powers they need to fight these terrorists. And I certainly don't like the idea that something that falls into the category of terrorism suddenly means we're suspending the protections that other citizens are accorded.
Oh, and of course, England going back to, or the UK going back to the 70, late 60s, early 70s, has effectively already done that because of IRA violence back in the day. And hopefully that's something that won't cross that's a British disease that won't cross the pond here. Although you're right, Catherine, that we are...
We've culled our Irish, yes.
Yeah. No, well, it's, but we're, you know, I mean, like, there's always that attempt. I'm kind of actually hopeful in terms of reactions to, you know, terrorist acts on the U.S., whether it's stuff like the Pulse nightclub or the San Bernardino shooting or whatnot, in a weird way. And it's, you know, it's not to, like, shrug any of that stuff off, but it does seem, you know, there hasn't been any kind of real movement on restricting access to guns, to Second Amendment rights. And it does seem like we're coming out of the post 9/11 period where everything that might be terrorism, you know, suddenly creates a national discussion or a national conversation and a consensus to lock down more and more parts of American life. So, you know, hopefully that will continue.
I'm not as optimistic on that front, in part because of what Catherine or Nick or all of us mentioned, the reaction by two leading presidential candidates last time around within 24 hours of one another to shut down corners of the internet. That in moments of stress is a popular opinion. And now you have a president, and presidents have a lot of leeway in investigative and national security areas. In ways that they don't elsewhere. And so I'm worried about when the next terrorist attack happens here, a large scale radical Islamic act of terrorism here. What is it that the president and his administration can control along those lines, and how far are they going to push it there? And it's going to be difficult for civil societies and civil libertarians to make that argument. I mean, all you have to do is turn on, you know, Fox and Friends in the morning, and you got a half a dozen people out there cheering on the concept of internment as a direct result of all this stuff. And granted, you know, they're losing audience share out there, and Trump is not a popular presidency, but this is always a popular line of argument. I don't know if it's majoritarian or not. Maybe it is. So we have to be on the watch for that, because that's going to happen during the Trump presidency at some point.
So what are the likely mechanisms that the Trump administration would use on clamping down on the internet? My understanding with Theresa May is that she wants internet providers to keep the search terms and websites visited of Britons for a year and then potentially turn them over to law enforcement. Is that something that might happen? Is it just from a devil's advocate position, is it something we should be truly worried about? I don't have that much interesting porn habits, so I don't know if that's a terrible thing in my case.
I think that the difference between saying, okay, let's retain some of this data, which is already retained to some extent in the United States, and saying you know, this much more aggressive language of denying the use of the internet, essentially, to people who we perceive to be terrorists or suspect of being terrorists. Now, I think the mechanism for that actually, it basically doesn't exist. But I can easily imagine and have already seen in the United States pressure being put on social media platforms in particular to censor themselves lest they be censored. And that's, I think, actually the place where more damage can be done. You know, data retention, that kind of thing. I don't like it. I don't think it's a good idea. I certainly don't think it should be mandatory. But I'm actually more worried about Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat doing stuff to try and stave off accusations that they are helping the terrorists because they are scared of what the government will do to them. That seems very, very likely to me to happen in the UK as well as in the US.
Yeah. And, you know, even though the UK is in the middle of pulling out of the EU has passed similar kind of restrictions on what counts as hate speech or actionable speech online. And, you know, weirdly, I think Catherine's right that that's where a lot of this stuff will end up happening on these social media platforms. And it always ends up censoring people who are not necessarily calling for Islamic jihad. It'll end up somehow, you know, when you're against the minimum wage increase or something, that'll be a, you know, an intolerable hate
speech.
It'll
end up with drugs. I mean, yeah. The place it always ends up is drugs. Yeah. The powers given to forestall terrorism or in response to terrorist attacks are always used more immediately and more widely in the service of drug prohibition. Like that's. I don't know if somebody else's law already. That's Mangue Ward's law. That's Mangue Ward's law, if it wasn't a law already.
I also think there's a tactical disadvantage that happens from trying to shut down any traffic or chatter from potential terrorists in that we can monitor it if it's in some sort of public capacity. Whereas if you drive it away, you don't have the ability to put in misinformation nor to figure out where people are talking about, what are the issues. It would actually potentially do a disservice to intelligence.
Yeah, have them shout it on the street corner, not whisper it in the back alley, right?
It may well be that, you know, terrorists like ISIS is, you know, they're the biggest users of MySpace these days, and it's just nobody's paying attention.
It's just bands that were formed in the 90s that still exist in ISIS.
Sam the Sham
out.
And the Pharaohs is actually a code word, yeah.
Yeah. So to go back a little bit in terms of politicizing this, I think Trump did tweet something to the effect of, you know, a lot of people were mowed down in a country that has very strict gun laws, presumably to highlight the fact that this still happened absent, that it still happened even though there weren't that many guns. And I've seen newspapers here in the United States say things like it would have been much worse if there'd been semi-automatic weapons involved and that kind of thing. Is this a situation where they would have benefited from looser gun laws or where, in fact, it did mitigate what happened there?
I think this is a situation where a different gun possession legal status would have mattered not at all, and that people just like to talk about gun control because talking about terrorism is too hard.
Yeah, I mean, the hypotheticals on, you know, what would have been like is one of the drearier aspects of our gun politics. You know, if we just armed every teacher, we would never have a school shooting again. This type of conversation, I don't think it's particularly helpful or illuminating.
I would like to arm every school teacher just recreationally, but
just put Betsy DeVos in charge of it.
Well, no, but, you know,
let's what about the Bears?
Yeah, the Bears. To pull it back to, you know, kind of a quote that's attributed to Robert Heinlein and William S. Burroughs. But, you know, an armed society is a polite society. And I do think this broad argument has actually held sway in America, which is that over the past 25 years or so, there has been a massive increase in the number of guns out in circulation, and there has also been an equally massive decrease in gun-related violence and homicides in the United States. So it's clear, I don't think you can necessarily say that having more guns means less violence, but it's an absolute empirical fact that the correlation is strong, that more guns out there does not mean more gun crime. And, you know, I don't think anything is going to change in a place like Britain or most of Europe, where they have much stricter gun control or gun ownership laws. But, you know, in any one situation, you never know.
Well, I mean, also those crime trends are pretty consistent throughout the West, and the gun policies are very different in throughout them. So everywhere after World War II, there was a long ramp up in crime between the 50s or even more strikingly, from 1960 to 1990, let's say. And then everywhere it fell apart, regardless, I think, of gun laws.
But you know what? Like actual property crime in Europe is higher than it is in America. And home invasion robberies, which a lot of criminologists attribute to the fact that criminals in England, like typically when houses in America get broken into, it's when people think nobody is home. In Europe, invasions happen all the time when they know people are home because they assume that nobody is armed. And, you know, that's kind of a rational actor theory that criminals, like everybody else, they weigh costs and benefits of their actions, which, you know, and I actually think that, you know, that's subject to debate whether or not criminals are actually, you know, how rational or instrumental they are as opposed to how impulsive. But bringing it back to you, Andrew.
Pro and con lists.
Well, not quite that way, but you know, very few of us, with maybe the exception of the people on this call, actually go through a full decision matrix before deciding whether or not to get that third cup of coffee. But to bring it back to what you were saying, Andrew, I don't think what's happening in England is going to have any effect on the gun control debate in America, which at least in many ways has been going very much in a kind of libertarian strong reading of the Second Amendment.
Well, there's yet another way we could potentially die, and there's lots of apocalyptic rhetoric surrounding it, which is that President Trump has pulled out of the Paris Accord. My understanding of the Paris Accord, based on my reading of it, is that it was sort of an international New Year's Eve resolution that we all agreed to, where we said we're all going to lose some carbon weight. We got to determine how much carbon weight we thought we would lose, and if we didn't lose it, there was no enforcement mechanism to punish us. And then Trump went, "Obesity doesn't exist," and pulled out. And everybody's freaking out now. Was he right to pull out? Or are we all going to die? Catherine, what do you think?
We are all going to die.
Okay.
Just to be clear, but not from this. And I think, you know, in general, this is, I think, you know, my Facebook is a carnival of social signaling in the Trump era. And nothing has brought that out so much as the Paris Agreement stuff. These were... essentially kind of, as you say, wish list, unhonored promises, which in many ways were lagging rather than leading indicators. You know, emissions in rich countries are falling per capita. They're falling because we are wealthier, not because every now and then we all get together in a room and agree to maybe try to do something about this gosh darn global warming. I don't think it matters. Trump's motivations in this particular case, I don't think they were particularly sound, but this is not an apocalyptic decision. This is not something that will change the fate of humanity as we know it, because people weren't actually acting in accord with the terms of this agreement in the first place, including the United States.
Well, it's also last week talked to Bjorn Lomborg, the skeptical environmentalist, the Danish scholar who runs the Copenhagen Consensus, and he pointed out, that the Paris Accord wouldn't achieve very much under its own terms, and the UN, even in its study, said that it was not going to have, you know, it would have virtually no effect on slowing global warming over the next 100 years. And it would come at a very high cost to economic activity and to business activity, and that it was effectively redistribution from wealthy countries to poorer countries for money. You're paying a lot for very little, and that it would be much smarter to rethink how countries kind of push for research and development in energy technologies that don't give off greenhouse gases. So, you know, there's no problem. I think the biggest thing here, and this is something that is worth thinking about from a libertarian perspective, Donald Trump did the right thing for the wrong reasons, as Catherine was kind of suggesting. And it's like, how do you factor that into a political analysis? Because if you are just anti-Trump and hence anti everything that Trump does, you're left kind of in a weird position where you would be criticizing him for a policy decision that you fundamentally agree with. And I think we should. There's no reason to be part of the Paris Accords.
If it doesn't really have strong enforcement mechanisms, and we can miss the goal and there's no repercussion of it, why not stay on board and then just see what happens? Matt, is there any downside other than rhetorical backlash?
The argument, I mean, it is an important question, and I think it speaks to the symbolic nature of this agreement, not just on the hysterical left, but also on the kind of anti-multilateralist right from which Donald Trump comes to. On some level, you think, why is this such a big deal? Why get the military jazz band in the White House Rose Garden to throw this particular party?
Because you should always have the military jazz band accompany all presidential activities, just to be clear.
This is true. We're all going to agree on that. The argument from the policy perspective, Andrew, is that Andrew, it's the first time I ever called you Andrew. I feel like awkward and dirty. Heaton is that it's not a treaty now. And it certainly was never submitted, as Nick rightfully pointed out to Bill Clinton on Twitter. Don't call this a treaty from an American point of view. It wasn't submitted as such to the Senate because everyone knows that it wouldn't have been passed. But that it would become a stealth treaty, that environmental activists would be able to use it since it had been ratified. It has been ratified by 75% of the world, that they would be able to use this in court to kind of force the federal government to meet targets in case they're not meeting targets. And so by getting out from underneath it, it forestalls that ability to happen. And I think there are good arguments for that. And Ron Bailey had a great post on May 4th that spells through this kind of creeping, backdoor treatyization of it as a legitimate reason to get out of it. But I think it's also interesting to dwell on the symbolism on the right. I think Trump gave a speech in, I believe, August of last year. That was the one where he talked about how Hillary Clinton is part of a cabal of international bankers that are out to destroy sovereignty. It's a really phenomenal speech. I mean, go read it every month just to remind yourself of what's going on here. I think that the Paris Treaty and the whole speech that Trump gave in the White House Rose Garden is really fascinating. I mean, it's an outer borough chip on your shoulder. That whole Pittsburgh, not Paris line, which was great. You just have to enjoy it. Just speaks to this. I'm so sick of these snooty elites in Europe and anywhere else and in America selling themselves out to that, telling us what to do. They're not going to tell us what to do anymore. And so the agreement had this incredible symbolic heft that was not, from that point of view, that was not matched in actual, restrictions. And a lot of what Trump was saying in the middle of that speech was just nonsense about trade deficits and how this is going to impoverish the United States and all this kind of stuff. It's garbage. However, it has that symbolic meaning to it, and it's worth reflecting on that. Both in terms of like, hey, that reason why that is potent is because there has been kind of an uninterrupted accretion of power among those kind of multilateral unelected bureaucracies out there, and people to some degree rightly resent it or feel like it's creating things that are beyond their democratic control.
Another thing that Ron Bailey raised, which keeps me up at night a little bit in this context and maybe argues for the, hey, let's just stay in and be bad treaty buddies, is, he said, listen, one thing this might cause is a backlash where signatories of the Paris Agreement, where real participants, impose carbon tariffs on American exports. And that, I think, is something that we should be concerned about. This goes to my general theory that like the second half of Trump's term is going to be spent in like litigating trade wars with the entire world, like one country at a time. So we'll see how that goes down. But that actually could be a way that we end up having to bear more of the cost of the notion of climate change than if we just left the status quo alone.
So aside from the political ramifications and the economic ramifications of this, from an ecological perspective, I'm curious as to how efficacious this could be compared to just letting the private sector do its own thing. I don't know if we met the Kyoto protocols. I know we didn't subscribe to them.
We did not. And those started falling apart the minute that they were kind of inked or decided upon. So this, in many ways, it was a follow-up to that. And, this may be the beginning of the unraveling of it, similar to the Kyoto Protocol, or it may be that America is the big renegade nation here. But You know, it's not fully clear what, you know, in terms of what China is doing and what India is doing and what the EU is doing, how much of this is going to play out. The United States is emitting fewer greenhouse gases than it was years ago. And that's because of technology. It's largely because of fracking and shale oil, and whatnot. And in, you know, the EU and in China, it may well be if they actually emit less, it's going to be because they're in, economic slowdowns. But this is the Paris Accord is very symbolic. And you know that because there's no enforcement mechanisms. And you know that because the United States, the president, the Obama administration didn't submit it to actual treaty ratification, because it wasn't going to be passed. And like most symbols, it's not even clear that it makes sense. We should be looking forward to a world in which energy gets cleaner and cheaper. We're actually achieving that, and we can do it even faster being outside of the Paris Accord than by directing more of the money that would have been sucked into taxes or however this was going to be paid for, and just putting it into research and development.
That's one of the things that I like about both Ron Bailey and Matt Ridley is the idea that the vast amount of change is going to come through innovation rather than belt tightening. Something that I talk to my liberal friends about is that when they bring up these apocalyptic scenarios that have the forecast of how much carbon is going to be emitted by the world, a lot of that's contingent on the third world not being so terribly poverty stricken, and that's a good thing because there's probably a lot of Steve Jobs and innovators that are right now just doing subsistence agriculture, and we might be able to come up with solutions that we hadn't thought about as all of those people climb up out of poverty.
Yeah, I mean,
let's
there's
do
this,
it.
Yeah, exactly. I would just add that it's frustrating sifting through the hyperbole on the left from this and from Jerry Brown, governor of California, or whoever is the governor of the state that I live in, New York, whichever Cuomo is looting the place now. You can't frack in the state of New York. So the same people who are lecturing Donald Trump about how we've just subsumed Miami with this decision, and we've imprisoned our grandchildren, are blocking the technology that Obama's EPA has and like the United Nations has like decisively concluded is the biggest single factor in reducing the United States's carbon footprint. So it would be a lot easier to swallow these apocalyptic visions and critiques if it wasn't for the same people who want to block those technologies that have been so helpful. And yes, a lot of that comes just from, well, we had this thing called the Kuznets curve, which originally was applied not to environmental concerns, but we've seen this observed throughout the industrialization of all economies. Once you get to a certain point in your development, more wealth equals more cleanliness, and it's hard for Americans to believe, except if you grew up in Southern California or other places where it was really awful before and it's not a lot better now. But like our water is cleaner, our airs, our skies are cleaner. We're emitting less carbon. Things are going in the right direction, and it wasn't. Some of it has to do with regulation, but the majority of it has to do with wealth creation and technology.
Nick, are we likely to see anything happen by virtue of governors and mayors voluntarily subscribing to the Paris Accords? I think there's the governor of Massachusetts, who's a Republican, mm-hmm. is teamed up with, I think, Jerry Brown and mm-hmm. a couple of others. And there's a variety of cities that are all piping
in. The mayor of Pittsburgh actually has said, that he's going to insist that Pittsburgh maintain whatever share of, its responsibility under the Paris Accord. Yeah, we'll see. Obviously, they can try and do a lot of stuff. And California has historically led on a lot of environmental claims. One of the things, kind of regulations, basically every car in the country in America conforms to California emission standards. One of the things that is interesting, and Matt, particularly as a California native, could speak to this. California is not the economic powerhouse that it was. And, it may be ceding certain types of innovation to states or localities that aren't as hell-bent on this. You know, the question is, do you want a better environment, and do you want a better economy, which, as Catherine was talking about, is the way that you innovate your way out of a lot of these problems. You know, there is a role for government policy, and particularly in things like air pollution, I think, and certain kinds of water pollution. But that ultimately, you know, just these mandates that are completely arbitrary. And again, going back to Bjorn Lomborg, he said, you know, he told me, and he's written elsewhere, that by 2030, the Paris Climate Agreement would have delivered about 1% of what it was claiming to deliver. So that you just have a massively expensive symbolic treaty that does nothing really to help the environment. But it does suck a lot of money out of the economy in order to kind of go through the motions.
Well, I'm glad that we're in agreement that we'll probably survive. That may not happen to the careers of a few people that have been digging holes from themselves in the media here recently. Bill Maher said the N-word on his show and is now doing an apology tour, as is, I think, Ben Sasse, the man that he said it to. So if you're unfamiliar with this, on Bill Maher's show, he was talking to the senator from Iowa.
Nebraska.
You coastal elite.
Nebraska, thank you. It's a flat state. It's a flat state with agriculture. I know that much. And he, Ben Sasse, for some reason, invited him to work in the fields in Nebraska, which is, of course, what you do when you're there. And then Bill Maher said, I'm not your field N-word, a word that I am so horrified to utter that I won't even say it when quoting him. And he's now getting eaten by the left on this one, or at least by a significant portion of the left. Is it ever all right to say that, Nick?
Bill Maher referred to himself as a house nigger, and he clearly was doing it to make Ben Sasse uncomfortable, because Ben Sasse is a conservative with some libertarian leanings Republican from Nebraska who's shilling for his book about how to raise responsible children. It's actually a pretty thoughtful book. Sasse is an interesting guy. He's a PhD in political science who actually was the president of a small Christian college in Nebraska, and he is an arch Trump critic. I mean, he's a very interesting character on the American political scene, particularly within the Republican Party, because he's never pretended to be Trump friendly or to make peace with Trump, even as he'll work with him or with Democrats on certain issues. Bill Maher is far more interesting in terms of he's always been kind of an apostate lefty or progressive. There was a time back in the 90s when he would refer to himself as libertarian. But, you know, he is very anti-Islam. He believes that all religion is bad, but that, you know, Islam is particularly prone to creating and promoting violence among its followers. He's a militant atheist, which rubs some people on the left the wrong way. He was demonstrated against at Berkeley. So, you know, this is part and parcel. You know, Bill Maher started out with a show called Politically Incorrect. And, you know, in a way, I think he's delivering on that.
Is the left correct in going up in arms that he used this in any context as a white man or at all? Is it acceptable for him to have made this comment? Matt, what do you think?
I'm not in the it's acceptable to make a comment business, generally speaking, especially with political comedians and else. My personal theory on this was forged in the hard scrabble baseball fields of Long Beach, California in the 80s when a friend of mine who was white thought he would get into the friendly banter of N-word, you know, in the middle of a sporting contest, and a future all-pro safety Mark Carrier just about ate his head clean off, which was an important kind of a call. I'm really interested, you know, Camille Foster, our friend, always talks about this, and Camille is much less likely than I am to say anything is racist in this world, I think, because he's younger and he's crazier and didn't grow up next to racist cops like I did. But his point is that intent matters. So are you using this in a way to intentionally disparage people? And I think to Nick's point, the only person who was supposed to be disparaged in this thing was either Ben Sasse for being a Republican who asked someone to work in the fields as if that's a problem, or Maher himself. Right. Because if you are calling yourself a house N-word, well, that's a bad thing within the world of slavery. That means that you're a sellout. You're working, that you are, you're delicate, and that you're also kind of working with the master against the actual hard workers who are out there in the field. And so it's interesting. I was, I think the first time that I went on the Marsh show, he referred to, he said that the NRA really stands for nuts, racists, and assholes. And it got nothing but like a standing O from the audience. He called Sarah Palin the C word. He's I don't know if he has made fun of her children for or child for having a disability or not, but that's
entirely
possible. So like he has had that intent and does pretty much every show to say things disparagingly against entire collective groups of people, and no one bats an eyelash. But this word is so toxic, and I think that there's more toxicity associated with it now than there was 10, 20, 40 years ago. You couldn't make Blazing Saddles now. You couldn't make Bad News Bears now. You couldn't make Pulp Fiction now for all these reasons. And some of this is a reflection of, well, we're kind of a better country than we were in 1976. And that's all to the good. But it's interesting that you can get away with, and this goes to Kathy Griffin too, of this collective demonization against entire groups of people, which I think is completely unhealthy in our politics right now. And that you can do more of, and you see more of it, I think, than you did in recent years. But there are certain words that are even more toxic than ever, and they can be career killers. So it's just an interesting thing for people to watch, you know, the potency of this language.
Yeah, but the only real career-killing stuff on this, you know, and this goes to your point, Matt, about both intention as well as kind of context. But, you know, somebody like Paula Deen, the Savannah-based chef who was big on the Food Network a couple of years ago, it turned out in a lawsuit against her brother who managed one of her restaurants down there, that Paula Deen had talked about, had used the N-word repeatedly in discussions and reportedly was talking about how great it was. Like she wanted to go to weddings where there were all black wait staff and they wore little white gloves, et cetera. And it was fucked up. And that really hurt her. You know, she got bounced off the show, the network, and I don't think she's come back because it played into something that was offensive. I'm not sure that that's a, you know, I don't want to say it's a fireable offense or not a fireable offense. It's weird. But, you know, somebody like Mara and somebody like Kathy Griffin, I mean, the most interesting thing about the Kathy Griffin stuff where she tweeted an image of her holding a decapitated head of Trump is that she immediately had to apologize. And there was a pretty large and vocal outcry against that. And on a certain level, I think, yeah, it crossed the line and it's stupid. And it is, you know, it's really, we're living in like troll America on both the right and the left. And that's screwed up. On another level, it's kind of maybe things are being equalized. But then on a third and I think more important level is like what we're seeing more broadly is the progressive left is really eating its own. And we see this on the speech cases that come out on campuses and whatnot, and the going after people like the feminist professor at Northwestern, Laura Kipnis, for creating a sexually hostile workplace because she wrote an essay that some grad students at Northwestern read that, you know, in the Chronicle of Higher Education. What we're witnessing now is the left eating its own because they've gotten everything that they want in terms of political correctness from the right in a lot of ways. And now they're going after Bernie Sanders supporters who they dislike. They're going after people like Bill Maher, who doesn't define himself as a libertarian anymore. He defines himself as a progressive.
I also think this is a great test case for fair weather free speechers. I mean, I'm never, ever going to say this, but I think that the correct response to this was the thing that the stupid politician said after the fact, like Ben Sasse's tweets the next day were the right thing to say. I'm a First Amendment absolutist. Comedians get latitude to cross hard lines. But when somebody says something like this next to you, you should probably say, hey, bro, why do you think it's okay to use that word? Like, that's it. That's the right answer. It's not actually all that hard. And for the Kathy Griffin stuff, I think like the point of the First Amendment is to protect incendiary political speech and unpopular political speech. That's the point of the First Amendment. It has lots of other good follow-on effects for other types of speech, but like holding up a decapitated head of the president and not going to jail for it is the point of the First Amendment. And yeah, it was a douchey thing for her to do. And yes, sure, have an outcry, but like, let's be clear on the legal line, which she is like well north of.
Catherine, do you think that Kathy was actually crossing the line? Like I looked at that and I kind of rolled my eyes at it, but it didn't. I didn't think she was insinuating we should go kill the president or anything like that.
Yeah, to be clear, the thing that I think crosses the line is when you're standing directly in front of the president pointing a gun at him and you say the words, "I'm going to shoot you right now." Like then we can send in the cops, although again, more for the gun pointing even than the words. But yeah, no, clearly she didn't cross the line. Clearly this was, you know, arguably dumb, bad, you know, cheaply provocative art, but it was definitely political speech, not something against which legal action should be permissible.
I'm more interested in the Kathy Griffin instance than I am in the Bill Maher, only because there's more of a interesting emotional arc to it, from what I can tell. She made this decapitated Trump picture, which I just rolled my eyes at. I didn't think it was terribly funny, and I didn't think it really drove a point home on anything. It was just kind of, I thought, more virtue signaling than anything else. And then she did a what appeared to be a fairly sincere apology video where she said that, you know, she hadn't realized that it was going to be such an incredible public outcry, which I think is legitimate. I could see myself saying something that I didn't think would stir people up and did, and then backing off it. And then she really, really prostrated herself and said she was way over the line and that kind of thing and went a bit far. And then over the weekend did a press conference where she said that she basically changed the narrative from I crossed the line to my career is being destroyed by President Trump and his family. And I am the victim here and I've been broken. And then she said that a few times and started crying. And it seemed to me, looking at it, that it went from kind of a understandable, I went too far, to a kind of liberal heuristic of there's always a victim and I'm definitely it. And she's kind of getting back into that groove. She also says her career is over. Nick, do you think her career is over?
Well, I think the thing that hurt her career, and I say this as somebody I loved, she had a couple of episodes that she was on Seinfeld that were very funny. And I liked My Life on the D-List, her reality show about being a third level, third tier celebrity. And her whole shtick was that she would meet bigger celebrities and then dish on them in her stand-up. I think her career was on the downslide because of the last few episodes of My Life on the D-List. So I think it's actually kind of pointless to talk about this type of stuff in the sense in the larger free speech context or anything. It's clear that there is and I hate to use these terms because I don't like putting moral valence on this, but there's a debasement of the public discourse. And I mean that, you know, somebody like Donald Trump, when he was running for president, he tweeted at one point that Juan Williams had asked, you know, had said very nice things to him in the green room and then criticized him on, you know, Fox News Sunday. What a low class move or something. And it's like, you know, Donald Trump is the president of the United States and he is saying things that are just like nuts or insane or beneath the dignity, not just of his office, but of kind of human interaction. On the left, and on the right, there people are willing to say things that are just contemptible. And it's polarizing and it's bad. I don't really care about that very much. And it's more a question of like, how do we, those of us who are neither super right wing nor super left wing, how do we create a discourse that we want to participate in and that more people will? And that doesn't mean you can't be funny. It doesn't mean you can't be provocative. It doesn't mean that you can't be dark or sarcastic or sardonic. But focusing on this type of stuff, I don't think gets us very far compared to what we see on college campuses, where there is a real attempt to shut down all sorts of speech that somehow, somewhere, someone thinks should be shut down because it bothers somebody.
Which is definitely going on right now at Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington. If you're unfamiliar with this, there's a sort of liberal holiday that takes place every year on this particular campus where the students reenact the ethos of a play where all of the minorities leave for a day to illustrate how the campus is bettered by their presence and that it really can't function without them. However, this year, some of the administration decided that it would be better, rather than having the minority students voluntarily leave to illustrate their point, would just excuse all of the white students so that they would feel what it was like. And one of the professors there, a man named Brett Weinstein, who is a fairly left-wing Bernie Sanders supporter progressive, wrote a letter back establishing that there was a difference between absenting yourself versus compelling somebody to leave, and has ignited this sort of giant, you know, People's Committee on Public Safety, French Revolution level furor at the college that's just really boiling all over the place. Is this yet another example of the left eating its own? Is there any? Do they have any actual grist in this issue, Matt? What do you think?
I think there's this weird tension happening. And you see it in all kinds of things. For instance, the discussion of the proliferation of different categories of gender and sexuality and these types of things. So on one hand, you have this flowering of identities and possibilities in ways that frankly blow my mind. I mean, like literally, I have no idea what people are talking about anymore with half this stuff. And I just feel like an old. So you have this infinite complexity on one hand, and then you have this bizarre rigidity on the other, policing the language to describe the complexity, or an essentialism that boils down all of life's complexity, whether it's race or gender related, sometimes even politics, into a binary, and it's bizarre. And so the way you have this is that, like, in an effort to, I won't say celebrate diversity, but make people mindful of differences and of institutional racism, things like that, people are engaging in all sorts of behavior which essentializes and cordons off people according to their race. That seems to me just really weird. I mean, there was it Harvard, Catherine, one of your alma maters, that had a commencement or graduation where just the black students created of themselves this year, or there's a proposal to do something like that. You see this in Evergreen with this. And I mean, even this stupid as that dumb Wonder Woman showing where they decided to have a woman, women's only Wonder Woman showing. And then I think Stephen Miller on Twitter bought a ticket and sort of made these points cascading from it. And especially in our trolling culture here on right and left, you're going to see this constantly here. And what I lament about it all is just that is the essentializing virtues of it. Like, how do you define someone is in category X instead of category Y? And why are you doing that? And why are you doing that in a way to show that it's bad to be racist? Like, there is an incoherence at the heart of all of this. And I feel like people aren't confronting that as much as they should.
One of the things I'm curious about with this whole phenomenon is this something that has really reached a fever pitch, or is it just that we in the media are far more aware of it? I mean, it does make for good fodder for pundits. I don't remember, you know, anybody at my alma mater, the University of Oklahoma, trying to, you know, kill a professor or anything like that. But it's possible that we're just unaware of it. Nick, is this something that really is different now?
Yeah, I think it's probably worse. And I say this as somebody, I graduated college in 85, undergrad, and then I was in grad school from 88 to 93, which is kind of the time when political correctness as a concept really came into being, or as an articulated concept. There's a famous New York Magazine article about political correctness, naming it, I think it was in 1990 or 91. And so there's definitely a shift, and I think it's proceeded apace. And I do, to go back to your earlier question, which feeds into this, yeah, it is the revolution eating its own. Absolutely. And, you know, you go back to like the kind of early modern era for revolutions that are mostly notable for good reformers coming in and then becoming worse than the powers that they replace. And it starts with Oliver Cromwell, who, once the loyalists were beat, the royalists rather, the cavaliers, the king's forces were beat, he wiped out the levellers, who, you know, were like modern proto-libertarians, actually classical liberals, from which a lot of what we think of as good virtue of limited government, he wiped them out. The French Revolution, as you mentioned, Andrew, they wiped out their own. They wiped out all their enemies, and then they started going through their own ranks to wipe people out. Simon Bolivar did the same thing after liberating a couple of countries. He became a tyrant throughout South America or wherever he could try to. You saw that in the Russian Revolution. You know, and yeah, that's that is what's happening, because in large part, the large aspects, I think, of systemic and institutional racism have been confronted and defeated. And now suddenly you're left with an apparatus and a power structure that has less and less justification in the big picture. And they start going after more and more things. We also, and Matt and I talked about this in the Declaration of Independence a few years ago, a lot of this stuff is just, it's kind of pendulum swings. And if you date the contemporary kind of freedom of speech on college campuses to the mid-60s in Berkeley, in particular in the free speech movement, it's important to remember that up until the free speech movement was born at Berkeley, because you were only allowed to talk about politics on that campus in officially designated places. And if you were part of the college Democrats and the college Republicans, and what people wanted to do was just to be able to pamphlet and leaflet and argue about wider range of topics, that ushered in an era of, you know, 10, 20, maybe 25 years of pretty wide ranging conversation that had never really taken place in American universities. There's always a pushback. And the only thing that's kind of surprising to some people is that the pushback is not from the conservative right, but rather from an authoritarian left. And I think what we're seeing now, when you have people like Laura Kipnis, when you have people like at Evergreen State, where they're not going after the lone conservative on campus. They're going after somebody who agrees with everything virtually that's being said. And you're saying, I'm not allowed to write what I want. I'm not allowed to think what I want. I'm not allowed to engage in conversation. And, you know, the left is the hard left on that is going to lose that battle, because I think Americans understand that you want more free speech rather than less free speech.
I'm just going to put in a bid here for like Isaiah Berlin for everybody, right? I mean, this incident at Evergreen is a perfect example of how a lack of understanding of the distinction between negative liberty and positive liberty puts you into a weird political places. I mean, the idea that there is no difference between freedom to and freedom from is exactly how Evergreen got itself in this position. And I think, you know, the missing piece of a lot of this discussion on campuses among the left is saying, you know, I should be allowed to do what I want when I don't hurt other people, is not the same thing as saying other people have to do what I want because I want it. It's just not the same thing. And that the Evergreen thing in which we say like, okay, we have this sort of laudable goal of raising awareness about race and racism. Everything is justified in pursuit of that goal is not true. That is not the right approach. I mean, reading about this, I actually read it twice because I thought I must have misunderstood, like that maybe they were saying, oh, there's some sort of event the white students are supposed to attend. No, it's like reading Lysistrata, except for like all the men have to wear chastity belts or something. Like it just doesn't even make any sense. And the idea that this professor has become kind of the sacrificial lamb, again, sort of for communicating what should, I think, have seemed like a very common sense idea to the student body. You know, that's a pattern that I do think is getting worse. The you know, at Yale, the big kerfuffle around the Halloween costumes and cultural appropriation was again the product of a professor sending out an email to a group of students who were, you know, under their tutelage and care, and saying something very common sense, something, you know, maybe you don't agree with it, but it's not
and
a crazy
too.
Thing to say. And
in a very respectful way to
right.
deliver that message.
And the, you know, the even this sort of secondary coverage frequently takes for granted or sort of credibly reports or credulously reports the notion that students are unsafe or feel unsafe or are physically threatened or that the rhetoric is violent without any evidence of actual physical coercion.
On top of that, you have an administration that's done just a wonderful job of catering to every single whim of the students there and throwing what appears to be a fairly kind and liberal professor under the bus. They've, you know, students have got the president to excuse them from homework. He's launching a forensics investigation to find who took the YouTube videos, which are amazing if you watch them. And then the faculty, the colleagues of Professor Weinstein, have written a letter saying that, you know, he is at fault for inviting this violence onto campus, and he's sort of the reason that this all happened. And it's amazing to watch all that. Nick, I'm curious. One of the things that has been coming out from the right on this is that some of the state legislators in Washington that are Republican are proposing legislation to privatize Evergreen College. It probably won't happen because the governor there's a Democrat, but is that a good method in dealing with this?
Well, you know, there maybe. And one of the things that's fascinating is, you know, the vast majority of college students go to state-supported institutions, you know, and it's somewhere like north of 80% of the total number of college students. What's interesting from a faculty point of view or an administrative point of view is that in most of those colleges, or at least at the bigger colleges that are kind of flagship research one style in the Carnegie designation research schools, you know, so a place like Ohio State, a place like Rutgers, where I was when as an undergrad, Penn State, et cetera, they get maybe 10-15% of their operating budget from the state. And so that they, for a relatively small portion of at least their operating budget, if not the capital budget and the ability to raise, use interest-free or municipal tax-free bonds and stuff like that, the state legislatures get a lot of time to kind of strut and, you know, bitch and moan about lazy professors teaching bullshit courses and why aren't people all getting jobs as engineers coming out of school. It might make sense in the American landscape to start spinning off some of these colleges from the college's point of view, especially if you believe in academic freedom and you want less restrictions put on a relatively small amount of money that you're getting from your state legislature. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think what's, you know, there's also something north of 4,000 four-year colleges and universities in America. There are probably too many colleges chasing too few students. And I think this kind of stuff is, you know, it'll be interesting to see if there's a marketplace of where students and their parents look at a place like Evergreen and they're like, you know what, I don't really want to go there. I don't want my kids to go there and send them to a different institution, whether it's in-state or out-of-state. I don't know that there's any truth of that because any evidence of that. The other thing is that, you know, it's also absolutely true, even at elite institutions to kind of non-competitive admission places, you can walk through college, and people did this in the 60s and the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now, without getting embroiled in a lot of this stuff, depending on what your interests are. So on another level, I mean, for me, I think it is worse. I think it is troubling. I think the erosion of the idea of open discourse and college as a place where you go to challenge your mind and learn uncomfortable and unfamiliar things is under challenge. That's problematic, but we may be overblowing it. And for me, the larger issue is that there are definite snowflakes on the left and there are definite snowflakes on the right who get pissed. I mean, you know, people like Sarah Palin, who came up in a slightly different context, she only exists to be pissed off by something that MSNBC or CNN or Kathy Griffin says. And, you know, that kind of world, I hesitate to say we should just ignore it because, you know, what you ignore can come up behind you and hit you with a bar of soap and a sock in the back of the head. But, you know, we should be busier creating the discourse and the intellectual communities and the cultural communities that we want to be in rather than worrying overly much about all of these idiots on either extreme.
Matt, do you think this is something that's likely to reach a fever pitch and then get better? Do you think this is something that's going to continue accelerating this you know, lack of cultural, if not legal, freedom of speech on the left at university campuses?
I don't know, man. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time on college campuses. I've always been the one who presumes that, you know, that everyone's talking about it kind of too much, or at least exaggerating the importance of its role in society. But then you start to, you know, look at that. I think some of that culture is bleeding into our overall culture now. I mean, just look at the difference in the subject areas covered in places that used to be publications that used to be pretty interesting in terms of a mixture of thought and appreciation for free speech. Thinking of places like Salon.com, The New Republic, for example, they're pretty social justice warrior-y now. I mean, there's that kind of vibe is much more apparent in the culture at large. So maybe there is something to be said. I mean, we have this great paradox again, where we have the best legal framework for free speech that's really become much more robust with Supreme Court decisions over the last 10 to 15 years. And we also have this technology that's creating all this remarkable ability to broadcast and send our speech and slice and dice it. That's happening at the same time that I think pretty objectively speaking, that the culture of free speech has been backsliding pretty badly and noticeably over the past 10 plus years. And the way that in which you get to a place being troubled by all of that is in, was it Barry Friedman's book, Nick, from 2009, talking about the Supreme Court making the argument, and I think it's a persuasive one, that the Supreme Court, generally speaking, not in each individual case, kind of ratifies where American public society or opinion got to, 10 years ago or something. So if we are culturally backsliding on free speech, then I worry that eventually the Supreme Court will start kind of ratifying that. So in that sense, we should pay attention to it and fight like the Dickens on protecting and expanding that culture as much as we can. And that will include going in on campus, on universities and talking about this stuff. And then just to answer your actual question, people I know have been paying attention to this. Just say that, the amount of that type of illiberal activity on campuses has really noticeably been spiking the last 2 or 3 years. And so it seems it's going to take a while to create the conditions which will cause that thing to peak and start going in a better direction.
One of the things that's interesting to pick up, though, on something that Matt was saying, when you look at Salon and the New Republic compared to in the 90s, say, Salon, which was one of the first big websites, like web-only sites, and was very heterodox. It had people ranging, from Camille Polly to David Horowitz to a bunch of people on the more kind of doctrinaire left. And it was a thing. It was something that had a broad impact. People talked about it. The New Republic, when it was more heterodox, was a bigger magazine. I mean, the New Republic is in, it's the Sears or Kmart of American political magazines. It had once dominated the landscape in a lot of ways, and it doesn't anymore. It went bankrupt, and now it's a shell of its former self. So they may perpetuate themselves as a kind of social justice warrior newsletter, but it's going to have less impact because it's reaching fewer people. And when you look at other publications like The Atlantic, which is pretty heterodox, it actually has more impact. And I think, to be honest, when you think about the growth, and this is largely a function of technology and the ability to distribute and market ideas more effectively via the internet and the breakdown of kind of mainstream media and a world of three networks and maybe a couple of cable channels, reason is doing much better than it was 20 years ago, partly because the ideas that we're talking about cut across kind of inherited political categories and ideological categories from the 20th century. I mean, what it meant to be liberal or conservative in 1980, it doesn't really make sense anymore. And there is a constituency out there, and I think it's growing, for people who want more individualized and personalized political categories or who also want to challenge themselves. So to kind of double down on Matt's paradox, we always, at the very moment that we have massive increases in the ability to speak our minds and to express ourselves in more and more individualized ways, we also have all kinds of threats to that. And sometimes it's kind of like a group like progressive lefties on campus who want to shut down Charles Murray and will go to the point of body slamming, the faculty moderator who ended up in a neck brace at Middlebury College because she was trampled by protesters. That's totally unacceptable. I don't know if that kind of stuff is on the rise. It certainly seems to be. And that's, we need to push back and kind of refertilize the arguments for why free speech is a good thing and free thinking is a good thing, because I do think that that's under attack, not just from, mostly from the left, I think, on campuses, not just from the left. And that's where we have to be really kind of making our strongest arguments.
Catherine, final thoughts?
Just that we also tend to have this weird notion that journalists and professors have special extra free speech rights. And we should, I think, you know, reason does, and we should point out that everyone has the same free speech rights. We do not need special protections for what professors get to say or think, or what journalists get to say or think. We should have protections for what people say or think. And we're actually moderately good at protecting the speech of ordinary citizens in private contexts, and get ourselves uselessly tangled in knots when it crosses into the academic and journalism spheres. So, free speech for everyone, the end.
Well, Nick, Matt, Catherine, thank you so much. I'm smarter for having spoken to you, and enjoyed this, and look forward to doing so again. That's The Reason Podcast. I've been Andrew Heaton. Thank you for joining us, and everybody here. If you haven't subscribed to us yet, please do so and come back.